Welcome to the Next Level Soul Podcast, where we ask the big questions about life. Why are we here? Is this all there is? What is my soul's mission? We attempt to answer those questions and more by bringing you raw and inspiring conversations with some of the most fascinating and thought-provoking guests on the planet today. I am your host, Alex Ferrari. I'm always looking to help the Next Level Soul audience take their soul to the next level. And I've been able to partner with Mind Valley to present you guys with a ton of free masterclasses between 60 and 90 minutes covering mind, body, soul, relationships, and conscious entrepreneurship. Some of these masterclasses are taught by spiritual masters, relationship experts, best-selling authors, legends in the personal growth and spirituality space, and so much more. So if you want to sign up for any of our free mind, body, and soul masterclasses, just head over to nextlevelsoul.com/free. Now, I have to tell you, today's guest is a first for me. We have on the show Father Nathan Castle. And for the past 23 years, Father Castle has helped more than 300 stuck and not so stuck souls who died suddenly and traumatically adjust to the afterlife. Victims of fires, automobile accidents, shootings, stabbings, drownings, and suicides come to him in his dreams seeking help to resolve their interrupted death experiences. Now, Father Nathan is quick to point out that not everyone who dies suddenly gets stuck. In this conversation, we ask the questions, is death survivable? How does he actually help people cross over? Does time exist in the afterlife? And do deceased relatives help us adjust to moving through our deaths? And so, so much more. So let's dive in. I'd like to welcome to the show, Father Nathan Castle. How are you doing, Father Nathan?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me here.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. I was very interested in your work and the kind of work that you do, and I've never come across the kind of work that you do before. So before we get started, how did you begin your spiritual journey?
Well, it started in Texas when I was born in Southeast Texas in 1956, and I was raised in a Catholic home. And I often tell people I didn't just learn the rules and regulations, the externals of the faith, but I had parents and two Dominican aunts who were first grade teachers. I'm a Dominican also. I learned the spirit. You know, they taught me not just the externals, but they taught me spiritual practice from early on. And it's really followed me throughout my life.
Now, you can you tell the audience the kind of work that you do now currently?
I live on the campus of the University of Arizona. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a campus minister as by profession any longer. I did that for 25 years. I help out here, and I do some work at a local church that's without a pastor. Mm-hmm. I do some online courses. I love teaching scripture to people that never really learned it, except maybe as, you know, in little chunks, spots here and there. But the work that we'll be talking about today is with people that died suddenly and tragically, violently. They started about 25 years ago coming to me in a dream in the night and showing me something that's a little like a video. You know, it's a dreamscape. And usually it has, you know, it tells me what happened to them without it being horrifying to me. It's sort of buffered. And I later get with a prayer partner, and we record the session that we do. I allow them to borrow my voice long enough to talk to my partner and explain what's happened to them and what they've been through. And they're vetted. They're ready to move from one level to the next in the afterlife. And they just need a little assistance doing that.
So I have to ask you, when this first happened to you in 25 years ago, you said, what was that like? What was that first experience like for you when this first started happening? How did you react to it? How did you handle it? What did you think?
Well, even from childhood, I had the practice of consecrating my sleep before I went unconscious. If you could imagine your consciousness being a ball or an object like a ball that you could hand to God and say, here, take care of this while I'm not using it. because I'm going to be unconscious. If there's anything you'd like to do in my unconsciousness with me, I might even be more receptive that way. So feel free. So I had that practice from childhood, and it was reinforced in religious life. There's a prayer called Compline at the end of the day in a monastery that completes the day, and it hands over consciousness to the Holy Spirit so that you can be available in the night. So that's some of the background.
When you got the first one, I'm assuming this is not normal when it first happened. So it wasn't like a normal occurrence. So what was your reaction and how did you feel when it first happened to you?
It was analogous to being awakened by a pager in the night. Many priests have the experience of being on some sort of rotation if they live near a hospital. And it's your turn on Tuesday to take the pager in case there's an emergency call in the night. So I've had many of those over the years where you're suddenly wakened out of a sleep. You're talking to somebody at the nurse's station. You need to rally yourself and write down a patient's number and room number and all that. It felt like that. It felt like being called into ministry in the night because of an emergency need.
Now, what exactly is a stuck soul?
Well, I have two books called Afterlife Interrupted. The first one, we used the subtitle Helping Stuck Souls Cross Over. And it seemed to me that some of them were in a trauma loop. They had died in trauma. Are you familiar with a trauma loop?
I am not. Please explain.
People that have been through some usually violent trauma sometimes can't get it out of their mind. And the last scene of it replays again and again, particularly plagues people coming back from war, where they've seen horrors, and somehow some little scene just won't calm down. You know, you involuntarily find yourself stuck in it, replaying it, kind of like Groundhog Day, you know, over and over again. Some of them were like that and needed to, in the afterlife, they needed some assistance from a team of people in the afterlife helping them regain agency, control of their own thoughts. That's part of it. Sometimes they're stuck that way. Sometimes they formed a thought that kind of painted themselves into a corner. It's all my fault the accident happened, and you know, other people died because I did a wrong thing, and you know, now I don't deserve anything good, and so on. It's not unfamiliar to your audience. If most of us have had at least a period of time when we had some way of thinking that in the end was unhelpful and maybe even not that true, but we lived out of it for a time. A lot of people that suffer with addictions are stuck in something like that.
So it's kind of like that. It's kind of that vicious circle, though. I think we've all experienced at one point or another where there's a thought that, like, I'm not good enough. I can't lose weight. But my mother doesn't love me. Whatever that is, you get stuck in it and you can't get out of it.
And there probably is a kernel of truth in it, but it gets all made out of proportion or whatever. It ends up moving away from the truth, even though there might be some little kernel of truth in it someplace.
Can you go through the process of what happens from the beginning to end in a quote unquote typical, a typical session?
Well, and they are typical after a while.
I know.
In my life. So anything that you've done for 25 years has something typical about it.
That's why I put it in air quotes.
I go to sleep. And maybe about one night out of the week, I'll have what I call a contact dream. It's not my regular psychobabble of whatever's going on in my psyche. It's from without. It usually is, as I said earlier, some sort of scene of somebody dying or being in a precarious situation that might cause a death. Lots of car crashes, for example, but not only that, drowning, shooting, stabbings, plane crashes, different things. But anyway, I'll have this scene that I'm receiving in a dream. I wake up from it. I write it down in a journal that I keep on the nightstand. I say a quick prayer for the person, introduce myself and say, good job. This, I, you know, you figured out how to find me and do the thing you just did. I hope I got it right. I'll be in touch with you, you know, sometime soon. Then I have a team of prayer partners, and we schedule regular meetings, like you and I had to schedule a time to be on a podcast. And it might seem strange, but we're all busy. And this is not the only thing that I do or that my prayer partners do. So we just schedule each other. When we're together, we first go into what I call protective prayer. I would not do Ouija boards or talk to just any old spirit. I don't think it's safe to pick up hitchhikers here or hereafter. So I make sure that St. Michael the Archangel, Holy Mary, a lot of it, I have a whole different cast of saint and angel characters that I first ask to surround us and keep us safe. And then I just ask the Holy Spirit to help us be in touch with the person that brought the dream, because it's their turn today. These can be done on Zoom, but during the pandemic, that you know, being in person was so impossible a lot of the time. I record them, and then I get them transcribed. We say we're ready, a lot of times I'll ask for the guardian angel of the person to give clarity and just to do something like a mic test. You know, mm-hmm. You do that at the beginning of the podcast. You know, can you hear me clearly? You know, mm-hmm. Are any little questions that we need to clarify before we get started? Sometimes, for example, a dream might have a lot of characters in it, and I'm not absolutely sure who's the one we're helping. Mm. And then sometimes more than one person crosses at the same time because they can sort of be in a group. So sometimes I'll ask about that. Sometimes something like the gender wasn't clear. Somebody died at the wheel of a car, but in the telling of the story, I really couldn't tell whether they were male or female. So their guardian will kind of come on and we'll have a little bit of a chat, and then they'll slide out of the way and say, okay, the one I guard and love is ready to do this thing. And so I'll be right here praying with you, but I'm going to slide to the side so that they can talk.
Now, is it kind of like a channeling? Do they talk through you?
They do. I avoid that word because in the Catholic Church, it's radioactive.
Fair enough.
I don't know that it needs to be necessarily, but that's the state of things. And so I prefer to use the word prophecy to describe it. Anyone that's been raised in mainline Protestantism or the Catholic Church would be familiar with a reading at a public service like a mass from one of the prophets like Isaiah. Mm-hmm. And in the section that might be read at public worship, there might be a narrative. The prophet Isaiah went from this town to that town, and then when he got there, he ran into this guy, right? Well, then the prophet then might speak in his own voice and then move from his voice to someone else or God using his voice. So there might actually be three speakers in the same block of text. Hmm. So I think of it that way. My voice doesn't change very much because it's the same vocal cords with air going through them. If I gave you a violin, would you know what to do with it?
Right.
You know, it could be a fiddle, you know, it could be country music or it could be classics. So the sound that will come out can vary a little bit according to who's using it, but not an awful lot. It's pretty fixed. A violin is not going to sound like a tuba, regardless of who plays it.
Exactly. So then when that person comes through you, they're talking to your prayer partner and explaining what's going on, what happened.
We're what I call co-conscious. I'm not entranced. I'm alert to everything. And my vocabulary is available, turns of a phrase. Sometimes people will use a word that they've never used before, but it was available in my vocabulary. Mm-hmm. So we're partnering sort of, but I try to be pretty much out of the way and just let the person say what they need to say. They have to stay in English because that's my only functional language. Although they don't have to have spoken English before, they can be from another country and form their thoughts as they always have, but they come out in English.
Now, so when they're talking, what are they saying? And so let's say they come in, they speak through you, you're recording it and obviously talking to your prayer partner. At what point what's the process after that? Are they just telling their story?
I skipped over a point that I should have made clearer. After we go into our protected prayer, the first thing I do is read the dream as I wrote it down. And many times they're only a paragraph long. Sometimes not. Sometimes they have a lot of detail, but sometimes they'll just be maybe a sentence or just a few ideas. But I'll read that. I usually pause the recording because it costs money to get it transcribed. So I pause it. We go into prayer a little deeper. We read it a second time just to let it kind of soak in, sort of like a tea bag, you know, just to be still in the story and allow it to move in us. And then when we've done that, that's when I say, okay, could we have the guardian, please, of this person or the person themselves? And let's get started.
And they're basically just describing their story?
Yeah, they usually comment upon, because we've just read this dream story as they related it, they usually comment on it because it's the last thing we were just talking about. And the prayer partner might say, did we get this right? Did we understand clearly? Sometimes there'll be symbology that you didn't quite understand and they'll make it clearer. And then they'll sometimes remark about the process. They've never done this before either. And they'll talk a little bit about what it was like. I'm told that my consciousness looks like a green sparkly river.
Okay. Well, okay. And
that one guy said, they bring you there, but you still got to launch the boat. You know, like you got, they bring you to the edge, but you still have to get in it. Something like current, you know, it's funny the way we use the word current to talk about money, currency. Mm-hmm. It's something that flows. We talk about electric current, what you and I are communicating via currents right now. Mm-hmm. And then at the subatomic level, that's what we are, you know, our bodies.
As energy, electricity.
An energy field, yeah. And so anyway, that's what they say.
So then at the end of that session, what happens? Do they go, okay, I'm good now? How does it continue?
The session normally doesn't take more than half an hour to 40 minutes tops, maybe a little bit longer if they're chatty. Mm-hmm. But usually when we schedule, we plan on doing two in a row in a couple of hours time with a little break time in between. So we just listen to their story. They often tell us what it was like to leave the body, you know, whether sometimes they're conscious during that process and other times not. Sometimes they awoke up in a new place. Many of the ones that we deal with, because they went through trauma are in something like a healthcare continuum in the afterlife. Similar to what would happen if you or I were in a wreck on the freeway, mm-hmm. and weren't able to care for ourselves, someone would come in and take care of us and take us where we needed to go to heal. Mm-hmm. And then even in a healthcare setting, you move from maybe the ER to surgery to ICU to a step down room all the way to the end of the line. And I think of myself and my prayer partners as like the discharge staff. The day you leave the hospital because you don't need this any longer, you know, gathering up yourself, you know, your meds. Do you understand when your physical therapy appointment is? Do you need, who's coming for you? Right. Partly we supply the ride. We help them figure out who's going to take you. They're going someplace they haven't been before, so a guide is necessary, and they understand that. So we help them oftentimes choose a person they'd like to have come for them.
Now, with all these experiences, how many have you done in your career?
More than 400.
So with all of that interaction with, you know, stuck souls and souls that are needing help to get to the other side, what have you learned about the afterlife?
One thing that we do is before we tell any of their stories in public, we go back to them and ask their permission, mm-hmm. which doesn't seem like the right thing to do right when you're in it, you know. Oh, and before you leave, I'm writing a book.
can you sign right here?
Yeah, that just doesn't seem appropriate. But when it comes time to, I have two books and there's 26 stories that have been told publicly. I'm starting a podcast soon.
Okay.
I want to have that to be another forum where I can introduce a new story, but not until after we've gotten their permission. But toward the end, we ask them, can you think of someone who loves you, who died before you did, who might be willing to come for you? Early on, I coached my partners to do that all the time. And then I found out that over time, people that are led to my line are kind of briefed. This is the way these people operate. If you do it this way, they're going to ask you this question. So they come prepared to answer that question anymore. And It's either somebody that they knew in their lifetime that they opted for. Sometimes they'll take luck of the draw. They'll just say, I don't care, whoever is the right person. Sometimes their guardian angel is already there. So they'll say, well, my guardian is already here. I don't really need anybody else.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Other times they'll just take the luck of the draw and the funniest people show up. Somebody from your first grade class, some kid you played with, you know, once upon a time, or, you know, most of us in high school had at least one person die while we were in high school, and there was an assembly and maybe we planted a tree in their honor. I've had that show up, you know, people, it can just be, lots of times it's grandparents. Once in a while it's celebrities. It can just be just about anybody.
I have to ask you, I was raised Catholic, so I am familiar with Catholicism and went through the whole gambit through my teens. What do your contemporaries say about this work, your colleagues say about this work?
Well, it depends. The folks that I live with, I live in a mixed community of four men and three women. Mm-hmm. And some of them are interested in it and ask about it, and others just don't. Mm-hmm. We all have our work to do, and we casually keep each other informed about what went on today, but we don't necessarily delve. So it really depends on the level of a person's interest. I do get some pushback once in a while, you know, get disinvited from a speaking engagement on another topic when they learn about this topic. I'm in the process right now of getting some help from some volunteers about building a body of literature and stuff about people that I've helped. After a show like this one, I might get stuff through my website of people that want to talk about something spiritual. A lot of it is grief support. I didn't write these intended to be grief support books, but the pandemic has made death and grieving even more difficult than it was before, because a lot of it's happening in isolation, or you couldn't really have a proper funeral. And there's a lot of suicide and a lot of drug deaths that leave people really wondering about their loved one and are they safe.
What drove you to this kind of work? I mean, this work is not easy. Just being a priest is not an easy path to walk. What drew you into this kind of work in general? Not the stuck soul work, but just the religious path.
Well, as a child, I was raised to believe that I could be anything I set my mind to. You know, mm-hmm. A lot of people have had that kind of parenting. I wish more did, but you know, that what, and they made educational resources available and encouragement and so on. And I remember asking, I went to Trinity in San Antonio, in Austin. I just thought college was a candy store. There's just was everything there, the whole universe, you know, on one block, right. Plot of land at the university. And I eventually asked this question to God, what does the world need one more of that I could be? Could I morph into I think of myself as a pluripotent stem cell. Mm. You know, those are running around in your blood system. And if you cut the tip of your finger, there are cells in your bloodstream that know how to become a fingertip. And I just thought I could become what I needed to be, would it help to make the world better. And being a priest turned out to be my path.
Now, how is time perceived in the afterlife? Because I read that some of the souls that you work with are recent, and others could be hundreds of years, quote unquote, hundreds of years old. They Civil War, that
yeah,
kind of stuff.
Yeah, they died decades ago.
Decades ago. How is it perceived, and how is time perceived in that afterlife from your perspective?
At first, I thought that it must be uniform, that there must be one way everybody perceives time or doesn't. Mm-hmm. And I learned over time that it really depends. That for people that want to pay a lot of attention to events on Earth, that's a possibility open to them, and then they become more conscious of the passage of time. Others look away from it and They can re-enter it. Like, for example, if you ask a person, what year did you die? You would think they'd have that at their fingertips.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But they don't always. Sometimes they, and I, early on, I started asking Americans, can you remember the last president that was, you know, who was the last president you can remember? And that, you know, would put me in a frame of time.
Reference.
Yeah. One thing that's important as these souls might have been stuck or moving slower than others is they're not made to feel like the dumb kids. You know, there's not a one size fits all sort of chronology. You ought to have this accomplished by this amount of time since your death. It's nothing like that. They just work at a fast pace or a slow pace, depending upon what they want to do. There's still sequence, even if it isn't happening in time. We're used to things happening one after the other, and we keep track of that with a clock. But in the afterlife, there's still things that happen as a consequence and subsequent to other things, even if it isn't measured in time.
Got it. So, I mean, I'm assuming you've heard of the near-death experiences and yes, people that go through that. How is that? Have you met any souls along those paths that have come and gone, or anything like that?
Not that they've mentioned. I'm a member of IONS, the International Association for Near-Death Studies, and mm-hmm. I'm around a lot of experiencers. I haven't had a near-death experience of my own. I've had what they call a spiritually transformative experience, an STE. Mm-hmm. So if you go to their conferences, they always ask everybody in the room, who's had an NDE? Everybody raise your hand. Who's had an STE? And my hand will go up there. I haven't run across, and the people that I've helped in this forum, I haven't had people that said, this is the second time I died, or I nearly died once, and then I did die this time. I haven't had that happen. Was that your question?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
No, I haven't run across that.
Now, the one thing I always found interesting, you know, growing up in Catholic school, is that when they told you, you have an all-loving God, but he's also built this torture chamber called hell. Even in first grade, I was like, this doesn't make sense.
You and I could have been in the same classroom because I was sitting there thinking the same thing.
I'm like,
four kids around me, you know, the other kids were doing the same thing.
We're just like, what is that? What? I don't understand the concept. Like, how can you be all loving and then yet torture people for a mistake?
Well, I can tell you right now that some of your listeners are disagreeing with you this second.
Oh, I'm sure.
People feel very impassioned about that. There's another way of looking at what I call the outer darkness. There people can still choose to be belligerent, and they can still choose to inflict harm and not to play well with others, all of that. And they can still do that in the afterlife. And I believe that they have to move off on their own. They're not, you know, they're not allowed to stay in polite company if they're going to behave that way. I do believe that there is something of a hell, but the idea that God created it in order to have a place for his enemies. Jesus taught us not to even have enemies. He taught us, if you have an enemy, love them.
Right.
And so I believe that there's security. I don't believe you're going to have to lock your doors in the afterlife. I believe that the people that I deal with have all made that choice that they want to be a part of the light and especially of truth. And there are others that are not doing that yet, but does that mean God wanted to create such a place, or that it's inescapable? Some of this stuff is theologically the proper object of ongoing speculation and mystery. It's really not my wheelhouse anyway. I'm not dealing with that. I'm dealing with folk that Catholics would call it purgatory. And sometimes I'm asked, why don't you just call it purgatory? And I say, well, that's language that only Catholics use, and not only Catholics die. And I'm not dealing with only Catholics. But purge means to cleanse. And some of the people I've dealt with absolutely use that as their main metaphor for what they need to do. They feel like they need to get cleaned up.
It's so fascinating talking to you, Father, because you as you speak, you're almost clinical in the way you speak about this. It's just very matter of fact about it, which I find almost refreshing.
in the way that you are approaching this. Like, it's just like, I got up, put on my pants, went to work, did my thing, as opposed to others that just look at it like, I can't believe you're doing this kind of work, but you're so, as a matter of fact, about it.
Well, I've been doing it for 25 years and
right.
There are just some commonalities in it. And my orders, I'm a Dominican, our order's motto is Veritas, which is just Latin for truth. And I'm only telling the truth. And whenever people do want to confront me or something, I at least have that as my comfort. I know that I'm telling the truth. And if it is upsetting to you, well, I'm not in charge of your response or your reaction to what I have to say. I'm only saying the truth as I experience it.
Now, there's so many things going on in the world today, Father. Climate issues, political yeah. issues. We're on the brink of a possible World War III, for God's sakes. The pandemic.
With nuclear weapons.
Yeah, exactly. So all of these things are happening to the world. It feels like there's a shakeup. There is some sort of rising of consciousness in the planet. There's definitely things changing. Things that were bedrock before are not bedrock anymore. Even in my lifetime, I've never seen anything like this. I don't think in yours as well. What's your opinion on what's going on, and where do you think this is going to lead for the consciousness of the planet?
Well, let me describe my response to it, because I've not lived through a time that has as much going on. All and you didn't even mention the pandemic.
At the very end, I said pandemic, yes, but
okay,
yes,
okay. Yeah. It just really does seem like piling on. You know, haven't we had enough? I just believe that I'm here to receive love, grow in love, give love, and I can do that on my deathbed. I can do it on my best day and on my worst day. I just try to stay focused on that. If everything falls apart around me, there'll still be people to love. In fact, there'll be more need of it then, perhaps. And I like to think that I was put here on purpose at a specific time and place, and that if I end up in a place where there's lots and lots of calamity and whatnot, well, okay, I'll do the best I can to receive love, magnify love, give love.
Do you see humanity shifting?
I'm around a lot of thinkers that see both all of the painful stuff, but also sense some growth in human consciousness. It's even the object of study here at the University of Arizona. There's consciousness studies programs. And mediumship is being studied here, spirit communication. I'm still optimistic. I believe in the cosmic happy ending. And man, do I see it in spades in working with these people who had horrific deaths. Nobody would like to die the death that these people do, but they end up with a beautiful story to tell afterwards. Not without struggle and effort, but that's the way I'm living. I'm playing around with the title Joyful Friar for my podcast, because St. Dominic, that was his nickname. And mm-hmm. It's why I joined this order. I didn't want to be a part of any of the ones that had blood and crosses and crowns of thorns and stuff. I just thought life's hard enough without kind of making it a theme. I just try to be, if I can't be joyful this second, I can wait. There's a prayer in the middle of the mass, you know, that I don't know if you've been to one in a while. You said you
probably not. No, it's been a few decades.
Well, do you know that prayer when we're praying the Our Father together at a mass,
mm-hmm, of course,
it comes to a stop at deliver us from evil. And then the priest says, deliver us, Lord, from every evil. Grant us peace in our day.
Right.
In your mercy, keep us free from sin. That'd be good, because it hurts people. And protect us from all anxiety. That'd be good too, as we wait in joyful hope for the coming of our Savior Jesus Christ. And I try to live in joyful hope, even if I'm not joyful just this second. I'm going to be joyful any minute now. You just wait and see.
Now, can you because I'm ignorant to what friars are, can you explain to the audience what a friar is, as opposed to a priest? Because I mean, and please don't take offense, the only friar I know is in Robin Hood, and that's Friar Tuck. So I know of the monk. I know what a monk is, but what is a friar specifically in that order?
The word is from in French. It would be frère. Or frater in, I live across the alley from a fraternity. It just means brother.
Okay.
So we join a family, a brotherhood, but within that, some of us, most of us become priests, and we're the title that we use is father, but I'm also within the order, I'm brother. So friar is just a word for brother.
Okay. So is that a subset of Catholicism, or is it?
It is religious life. We were the first, us and the Franciscans were the first Catholic organizations to leave the monasteries. Mm. The monasteries go all the way back to really, well, the eremitical movement going out into the desert predates Christianity. Mm-hmm. But Benedictinism is from way back, from like the 300s. We go back to the 1200s. But we were among the first to have the spirituality, the prayer life of a monk, but not behind the walls, out doing things in the world.
And got it. Okay.
We're called semi-contemplative. So at my best, I'm supposed to have the contemplative quietude of a monk, mm-hmm. but the availability to you and to other people outside the walls.
Fair enough. That's a great definition. I wanted to ask you, what is pre-death visitation?
I was just talking to somebody the other day. I'm doing a funeral soon for a woman that just had one. Pre-death visitation is that experience of a person, especially people in hospice, where their death is approaching, and it's understood that it's coming, where people start having, you might be in the room visiting your loved one, and they start talking to their mother who died 30 years ago, where there begins to be an overlap of worlds visits from people that are on the other side, kind of getting the dying person ready to leave and come with us.
Got it. And that happens. I mean, I've had experiences in my family where, you know, a relative is dying or dies, and we don't know about it till the morning, but you have a dream with that relative that night. Stuff
Did
like
you
that.
That happen as a child?
I personally have never had that happen to me, but I've had relatives who've told me that, like, I had a dream with Aunt whoever who was at the edge of my bed last night, and then when I woke up this morning, I found out that she had passed. We knew she was going, you know, either cancer or something she was going, but it just happened that those kind of visitations. And I heard my grandmother talk about it. My other family, a handful of family members have had that happen.
That wouldn't be a pre-death visitation, because it sounded like the person already left the body and on their way out visited you, you know.
Maybe it could have either been that, or it could have been I guess, I don't know, because it wouldn't be a pre-death visitation, but I have heard of, like that, exactly that example that you gave was like when you start talking to their mother who died 30 years ago.
But there's also another genre, another set of stories about like grandchildren knowing that mama passed during the night. Elders will somehow visit a grandchild on their way out, say goodbye or something like that.
The kind of work that you do, is there a history of it? Are there, how far back is there any recorded, any recordings about this kind of work?
Yeah, the ancient Greeks had a word for it called psychopomp, a person that did this kind of help. I haven't really researched it. You'd think I might, but I just stayed with what I'm doing. I've read very lightly around that. And I know that it shows up in different religious traditions and cultures and so on. And since I've been public about this for about the last 3 years, I routinely get contacted by people who also do this kind of work, but they do it in very different ways and styles.
Right, in different, either Judaism or Hinduism or...
Or no religion at all. I'm spiritual. One woman that does it while she quilts. something about she gets very calm when she's quilting, and then quilting, I guess, involves layers of different kind of fabrics that you're putting together, and something about moving somebody from one level to the next happens while she quilts. And I sometimes talk with people because some of their spiritual experiences feel sort of intrusive, and I just coach them into saying, if you have spiritual gifts that you believe that you're to use, you're in charge of you. You get to say when you do it and when you don't. You don't have to be open 24/7. You can lead a life with a spouse and kids and a job and still do this
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Choosing when and where you want to employ it. It doesn't have to be random.
Now, in a lot of the Eastern philosophies, meditation is really heavy. It's heavy in the practice of what they do on a daily basis to reach the inner self, the higher self. Yeah. What do you do in your practice to touch the inner, to touch the higher self within you?
I do contemplative sits where I try to think of nothing and be still eventually, anybody that's meditated for a while, you can begin to look down on yourself and see yourself from another point of view. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that's called the observer. And once you get used to observing yourself in contemplation, you can see a lot of foolishness, see a lot of reactivity. You know, people get angry at me because of things I said on a podcast and then write me an ugly email. Well, do I have to react to that? I don't have to. I could go into my higher self because my meditative practice has taught me how. And I can just say, God bless them, and go on to the next thing and not have my consciousness all roiled about that kind of thing.
So these contemplative sits are a form of meditation, if you will.
Yeah, I distinguish between meditation and contemplation. I was taught that meditation can involve active symbology and mm-hmm. imagery. I have a guy, I wrote a book on the Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
And I have a Wizard of Oz based meditation. At the beginning of the film, Dorothy is dismissed by everybody, by Audiem, by being told, you're always worrying yourself into a fret over nothing. Go and find yourself a place where there isn't any trouble. So I have this meditation that's called The Place Where There Isn't Any Trouble, where you use each of your five senses and ask the Holy Spirit to bless them and take you to this place within that's trouble-free, that's unique to you. And anybody that wants that, I can send them a copy of it. That would be full of imagery, which would be the opposite of contemplation, which is trying to think of nothing.
Now, can you tell me a little bit about that book, the Wizard of Oz book?
Yeah, let me get a copy of it. I got one sitting right here. I should have put it on the desk where I wouldn't have to leave, but here you go. It's my first book. It came out in 2011, so it's more than a decade old now. But here's a picture of it. The Wizard of Oz is a spiritual adventure. I meet so many people like yourself that have some childhood training in organized religion, mm-hmm. but who are disaffiliated from that. Mm-hmm. One of the consequences of that is we begin to not have common stories because we don't come together to hear them. And part of the kind of, I think, social fragmentation in the US is partly a consequence of the depopulating of the religious bodies. There aren't as many people that go to church or mosque or synagogue or whatnot on a weekly basis as there were when I was a youngster. Mm-hmm. And so we're losing some common story and some common language. But one common story that most of us have is the Wizard of Oz. And in my childhood, it came on once a year and you had to watch it. You know, you couldn't record it. And it brought people together across generations. And it was a Super Bowl party before there even was a Super Bowl. People talked about it for weeks in advance, where they were going to watch and what they were going to eat and so on. And I just watched it create community. So some years ago, thought, let's take this book and walk through it kind of contemplatively. And I was asking, why has it been seen by more people than I've ever seen any movie ever made? you're a communicator, you're a podcaster, you're trying to reach an audience. Why is this got a wider audience than any movie ever made?
Why? That's a good question, because I mean, I come from the film industry, so I've studied film and I've been a filmmaker and so on. So, I mean, of course, I've seen The Wizard of Oz many times, but you're absolutely right. It's probably one of those films that has been watched more times than any other film ever made, almost. I mean, now Gone with the Wind, but that it's a little bit older. For its time, it was big. You could argue Star Wars has been seen by so many people around the world, affected billions of people around the world. There are certain films, but Wizard of Oz is just one of those universal films that almost everybody has heard of at one point or another.
Yes. And oftentimes, if you sing the first few notes of a song, they burst into song. I like that because I'm very big on the incarnation, the Christian and Catholic idea of God living inside us, living all around us and being within us. And the Wizard of Oz story is incarnate inside of people. You don't have to tell them about it from outside. They already have it inside, and you're just reminding them of something that's within.
So what is it about that story that rings so true? Because I mean, look, in today's world, the visual effects and the pageantry of what it was in the 30s when it was made doesn't hold up in the same way, but yet there's still something about that story that connects on a primal level. What do you think that is?
Well, do you know Joseph Campbell's work?
Of course, yeah, the Hero's Journey, yes.
Yeah, and the monomyth. He believed that underneath all the major stories in the world, especially origin stories, how the world came to be, and heroic individual stories,
correct,
follow a similar circular pattern. And the Oz story follows that pattern of somebody minding their own business, having something interrupt their
ordinary
life,
world, yeah,
send them into the extraordinary world where they meet the allies and the nemesis. Around, I think of it on clock face. By the time you get to around 6 o'clock, 6 and 7, you're fighting a battle that could kill you. You finish that battle only to find there's another one after that. Right when you're exhausted, now you've got to do the next thing.
There's a point of no return too. Like there's a point where you can't go back to your ordinary world. You have to keep going. All these.
And if you were to go back and look at the Wizard of Oz, think of the story just before she clicks her heels together. She knows she's leaving here. You know, the thing with the balloon took off, but now she's definitely going to get to go home. And it's like a deathbed scene. She's saying goodbye to all these people and she'll never see them again. But I don't belong here and I need to go. Like, did you ever have to tell somebody, Mom, it's okay. You know, you can go now. That happens a lot in hospice work. She's told it's time to go and she can go and it's not a bad thing, but I have to say goodbye. And then she wakes up in her bed with the same people, they're just looking a little different. All the characters that she just said goodbye to are at her bedside in Kansas.
So would you consider The Hero's Journey, and specifically Wizard of Oz, an analogy for our experience here on Earth? Because it seems that way, that you go, your ordinary world is, let's say, the other side. You come here, you incarnate, you go through life, and then you say goodbye, and you're back to where you started,
yeah,
but a little different.
And not only different, but Campbell called it greening the place of origin, bringing the elixir of life, or whatever, something that
knowledge,
all the knowledge and experiences that you've just had enrich the new world, and it's not the world that you left. Maybe you and I do a retreat based on it. I have one all ready to go that can be done on Zoom, but for people that love film, walking through it together and pondering it.
Yeah, because I mean, for contemporary, the Wizard of Oz for my generation is Star Wars. I mean, that's the movie that it follows the hero's journey so perfectly, because George Lucas actually spoke to Joseph Campbell about it and worked with it, and is as perfect of an example of every point in the hero's journey that has ever been made. And that movie obviously had spectacle also, but there's very few films from the 70s that hold the same way that Star Wars does. Maybe Rocky, which also has a hero's journey.
Yeah.
You know, but like there's, you know, Easy Rider doesn't hold the same. Taxi Driver great, but doesn't hold the same. It doesn't have that kind of general feeling that everybody just adores it. Rocky and Star Wars are the only two from that era that hold in that same way. And even Rocky's dated, where Star Wars, not as dated. It doesn't feel as dated. There's something so primal about that story that we all can feel. And The Wizard of Oz was an earlier incarnation of that.
And it never really goes away. It keeps being refashioned or something. Oh. This is the 100th anniversary of Judy Garland's birth.
Oh, wow.
And there are all kind of festivals that are all, you know, about Kansas towns with yellow brick roads, you know, and anywhere that Frank Baum, the author, or Judy Garland ever lived, there's a festival and so on. It never really goes away. And Halloween, I mean, those characters keep showing up all over the place.
Wicked. So, I mean, the whole Wicked Broadway show. I mean,
yeah, and I would love to see Wicked be a film. They tried making it into a film, and I don't know why the project collapsed, but it did.
It's Hollywood. That's why.
I'm 66 years old. And anybody my age and older has that shared experience of crowding into a living room and watching Wizard of Oz every year in a crowd. So there's still a group of people that are now later in their life, for whom it really is a good vehicle for self-reflection and pondering my whole life story. And I do retreats asking, where are you in this circle? You know,
right. Where are you in the hero's journey right now? Because right. There is, and I mean, I've studied Joseph Campbell's work extensively throughout my career, and not just by watching movies, but reading his books. And I have his book, one of his Power of Myth, right behind me as we speak.
Have you ever talked to him?
No, I was not. I've only spoken to somebody who was friends with him. I've never had the blessing of talking to him before he passed.
I mean, after.
No, not after either. I don't have your skill set, sir.
Oh, but you can at least stand. Even if you don't receive, you can always say, hey, you know, remember how to do this? You know,
yes.
No, I'm the priest guy, your buddy, Father Nathan. They hear you, and they can be part of your team.
Well, it's fascinating, because his work, when you start analyzing your life, we all go through many heroes' journeys throughout our lives, you know, whether it's at a job, through a relationship. There are no points of return. You have your ordinary life. So let's say I'm living in this one town, like I'm going to move. You're leaving the ordinary world to go on an adventure to a new place, or
like Austin.
Like, oh, exactly. I lived in Los Angeles for, you know, over a decade. That was my comfort zone. Before I lived in Los Angeles, I was in Florida. So leaving Florida as a young man, going to Los Angeles, not knowing anybody, was completely an unknown. Sure. And there was moments where you're just like, could I go back? I never thought of that. But, you know, there's I love the point of no return, which is about 12 o'clock on the, or 6 o'clock on the clock. If you're doing the hero's journey as a clock, around 6 o'clock, halfway through the story, there is something that happens that after that moment, there's no returning back to where you are. Either changed, or something has happened so dramatic that the bridge has been burned. You have to move forward. Up until that point, at any moment, you could have chosen to go back. And that's a really interesting concept when it comes to your own storyline in your own life.
Well, on retreats, sometimes especially if I get people for like a weekend, I love it to do residential retreats for a weekend. Of course, during the pandemic, those went away, but maybe they'll come back. Where when you get to have breakfast, lunch, and dinner with the same people and kind of leave your ordinary world for a while.
Yes.
Maybe even turn the phone off if you dare. you know, not check your stocks or whatever it is that people are doing when they're on their phones. You get to be in a small world with people, and you can start talking about what are some circles that have come full circle. What are parts of my life that already have resolved? And as you get older, you can look at some of those resolutions and you can apply the lesson to the one that's unfinished right now. You know, you might be in the middle of something right now, but you can say, you know, now that I think about it, it reminds me a little bit about this earlier part in my life, and that didn't come out so bad. Or even if it did, I survived it.
It's interesting, because I look at a life's journey as a storyline in a movie, where there's the overarching arc of the entire story.
Right.
But within it, there's subplots that are constantly going around, and these like little mini journeys. And each mini journey is essentially a scene in a movie. So that scene has a beginning, middle, and end. So you go through a hero's journey even in these little scenes. So that's why throughout your life, there's like a relationship. You know, you have kids, a new job, a career change, something happens to your, you know, your body, you're shifting your body in one way, shape, or form.
And deaths of loved ones.
Deaths of loved ones, all these kind of things that are constantly shifting you. But there is an overarching arc, and you can only look at that from the observer's point of view as you get older. So I'm 47. So I've been around the block a few times, and now you start getting to the point where you start looking back at your own journey, and you just like, what I thought was the worst thing could have ever happened to me was actually, I'm really blessed that it did happen, even though it was a horrible experience, but I
stopped. What if we co-led a retreat like that?
We could have a conversation about it. That would be interesting.
Yeah. I'd love to come to Austin.
That would be a very interesting conversation without question. Now I'm going to ask you, Father, a couple questions that I ask all my guests. What is your mission in this life?
It's to receive love, magnify love, give love.
And what is the ultimate purpose of life?
I believe that's it.
Same thing.
I believe we're created. I don't believe we're accidental. And mm-hmm. I believe that we're fashioned, where everything I'm looking at on your screen was designed. And it Aquinas and Aristotle taught that nothing comes to be actually until it first existed in the mind of its creator. Mm-hmm. And I believe that the universe existed in the mind of its creator. And you and I were part of that imaginative work. Even in the Bible, on page one, when the curtain opens, you meet God, and the first thing God's doing is creating. Mm-hmm. You know, you're a creative guy, and so am I. I think we're just chips off the old block. We're doing what comes naturally, because we came from a creator, and we're given the opportunity to create. So, and then I just think, you know, didn't your parents teach you to try to leave the world better than you found it?
Very much so. Very much so.
I just think you can do that every day of your life. You can do that on a deathbed if you have to. You can smile at the nurse.
At the nurse. And you're absolutely right. It doesn't take a lot. It doesn't take a lot. But I agree with you without question. Now, where can people find out more about you, your books, your work, and the work that you're doing?
The easiest place is through my website, which is my name, Nathan, Nathan. Castle, Castle. So the website's nathan-castle.com. If you go to the upper right of the homepage, there's different icons for social media. The YouTube one, during the pandemic, I've had the leisure to get it all cleaned and organized. It's not a mess anymore. It used to just be kind of this digital dump. Now it's really organized. And I do a lot of stuff that's not related to the afterlife work as well. I teach some scripture, and I teach meditation and different things. Those are probably the best. And I would, if you want to contact me and get a reply, go to the website, and on the upper left, there's one of those little envelope icons that gives you an email. So it's info@nathan-castle.com. I'm very responsive to that. I don't like Facebook Messenger. And I don't, you know, sometimes I don't even think to check all these other websites for stuff. If you really want a response out of me, send me an email, because I'm on that all the time.
Father, thank you so much for coming on the show. I appreciate the work that you're doing, and thank you for everything that you do. And thanks for being on the show.
Well, it's been a joy. Thanks for having me.
Well, we've covered near-death experiences, shared death experiences, and now interrupted death experiences. I want to thank Father Nathan for coming on the show and sharing his journey with us. If you want to pick up any of his books, Afterlife Interrupted series, head over to the show notes at nextlevelsoul.com/062. And if you've only been listening to this over podcast and you want to watch these amazing conversations, please subscribe to our YouTube channel at nextlevelsoul.com/YouTube. Thank you so much for listening. And remember, trust the journey. It is here to teach you. I'll talk to you soon.